is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Raleigh Continues to Lose HQ Operations. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle and Sugata Mukherjee with the Dateline of Raleigh. North Carolina's capital city is losing much of the clout and prestige that comes with being the headquarters of a major national brand after Virginia-based Advanced Auto Parts announced this week it is acquiring Raleigh-based General Parts International for $2 billion. The deal marks a second major headquarters loss for the region in a month. The Raleigh-based car drug pharmacy chain announced in September that it was being acquired by competitor Walgreen Company. Car Drug has since notified state authorities that it will be eliminating 84 jobs in 2014. General Parts has been a privately owned company since it was founded in 1961 by Raleigh entrepreneur O. Temple Sloan Jr., and its owners have always been private about the size and scope of the company's operations in the Triangle and across the country. But according to data from Advanced Auto Parts, General Parts generated $2.9 billion in revenue the last 12 months as of the second quarter of 2013, and employs about 17,000 people. A Carquest store owned by General Parts is said to generate about $1.1 million per year. General Parts employs about 500 people in Raleigh, making it one of the largest privately held Triangle entities. So far, it's unclear how the acquisition will impact General Parts' Millbrook Road headquarters and employees. In an October 16 conference call, Advance Auto CEO Darren Jackson said the company expects to generate $160 million in annual cost savings within 3 years after closing. Most savings will come from combining purchasing systems, from scale and leverage of both corporate and store operations, and through supply chain savings. General Parts owns and operates 38 distribution centers. Advance Auto Parts has 12. It's too early to get into the precisions of the mix, as Advance Auto's CFO, Michael Nerona, during the call. What's next for Sloan? Sloan, who made his money and garnered his influence mostly from General Parts International, is also one of the largest real estate investors Raleigh has ever seen. In a recent interview with TBJ about the financial pressures engulfing the auto parts industry, Sloan swiftly pivoted the conversation to how leadership qualities are the cornerstone of a profitable company. While it's uncertain how much the Sloan family will make out of this $2 billion deal, they may have just become the Triangle's next billionaires. If so, that could be a good thing for the area. Sloan has demonstrated he is acutely aware of the needs of the community. As his friends and business partners, Steve Stroud, owner of NAI Carroll Atlantic, and Roddy Jones, founder of Davidson & Jones, told TBJ, many of Sloan's good deeds are never publicized because he wants to keep it that way. In so many ways, Temple is a private man, Jones said recently. When Wells Fargo was doing the deal with Advanced Auto Parts, the finance guys had to be on their A game. Temple Sloan Jr. has never shown much patience for ignorance and mediocrity. Sloan is unlikely to sit on his glory and see the days pass by. He has a firm, Trail Creek Investments, through which much of his real estate dealings take shape. Expect him to continue to look for deals and continue the expansion of his portfolio. And our cover story in this issue of the Triangle Business Journal has the headline, Hospital Mergers Unmasked. Reporter Jason DeBrun delves into the world of hospital mergers. Where will the next one happen? Will there be more to come? Could Wake Med be a target? In the next decade, as many as one-third of all U.S. hospitals will either be acquired or have formed some sort of merger agreement with another healthcare system. Most healthcare economists confirm this trend, which means the number of hospitals in the U.S. will shrink from about 6,000 in 2013 to roughly 4,000 as soon as 2020. While rural hospitals are the primary targets for acquisition or merger, the trend has some local healthcare leaders wondering if one of the Triangle's big three healthcare systems are ripe for the picking as well. Given its recent financial results, speculation has turned to Wake Med Health and Hospitals. Last fiscal year, which ended September 30, WakeMed posted its first operating loss in years, and it projects a best-case scenario of a break-even budget this year. In addition, the $1 billion system is looking for a new chief executive after it unceremoniously parted ways with Bill Atkinson in late September, citing a difference of opinion in the future direction of the hospital. "I don't think WakeMed will be out there too long on their own," says Payman Zand, a partner with Raleigh's Vaco, an executive search firm who specializes in the healthcare industry. Zand worked as the global director and divisional chief information officer for Dow Chemical Company for 7 years before taking a job as director of planning at UNC Healthcare from 2010 through early 2013. WakeMed's niche. WakeMed officials insist such speculation is unfounded and that they have no interest in being acquired, with more than one executive saying such a suggestion is off the table. Board of Directors Chairman William Wally McBride explains that as a nonprofit hospital, WakeMed has a different set of stakeholders to whom it is accountable. Instead of shareholders who could be interested in a payout, WakeMed is responsible to carry out its mission of treating the county's low-income patients, the original mission WakeMed had 50 years ago when it was established as a county hospital. "Our mission is to provide excellent, non-discriminatory care for all who walk in the door," McBride says, adding that the stakeholders are patients, employees, the county, the mission, and the physicians that work with WakeMed. "We can't conceive of any improved position to all of our stakeholders that would come from anything other than staying independent. We have the mission. We don't think anybody else will do the mission as well as we can. I think the county knows that. It's hard to see how the mission is furthered by any sort of agreement like we are talking about." WakeMed, like many hospitals, has fallen on financial hard times. For the fiscal year that ended September 30, it posted a $7 million operating loss and is projecting only a break-even operating budget this year. The three prior years were stronger. The hospital posted operating gains of $20 million, $33 million, and $55 million in 2010, 2011, and 2012, respectively. Overall, patient revenue figures have grown steadily and are now at more than $1 billion annually. The hospital is still on track to find an interim CEO by the end of October and a full-time CEO in 6 to 9 months. It hired Doug Vincel, a longtime chief operating officer of WakeMed, who served in the chief executive post at Duke Raleigh for 7 years before retiring in 2012, to help fill both of those roles. Vincel says one or two down years do not make a trend, but acknowledges that financial realities across healthcare should be among the focal points of any new hire. Of course, facilities like the new and soon-to-open HealthPlexes, and especially the new WakeMed North Hospital, which are projected to be more profitable than the main hospital on New Bern Avenue, will help the overall bottom line. "This is a pretty crucial 24 months," McBride says. The pressure is on. Other local hospitals are feeling financial pressures as well. UNC Healthcare adopted a budget that shows a slight operating loss. While Duke Health doesn't make its operating budget public, it just invested tens of millions of dollars to upgrade its electronic health record system. And Chief Executive Dr. Victor Zhao has said the system needs to look for ways to trim costs. That systems are feeling pinched financially shouldn't come as a surprise. More than half of a hospital's patient mix comes from the government through Medicare and Medicaid, with the federal government looking to trim costs wherever possible. Reimbursements to hospitals can land on the chopping block. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, 21% of the federal budget, or $732 billion in 2012, went to major health programs. Medicare, which provides health coverage for the 48 million Americans 65 and older or with disabilities, accounted for $472 billion of that total. Even small cuts to that program mean millions lost to every hospital in the nation. In addition, hospitals now face penalties if patients come back to the hospital within 30 days of a discharge. Before these penalties, hospitals could treat the same patient repeatedly and charge a full bill each time, what was referred to as a fee-for-service model. "Those factors make it very difficult to compete," says Russ Herokovich, managing director of GE Capital, Healthcare Financial Services Division, which recently analyzed M&A activity in the healthcare sector. How do you grow when you're being paid less and seeing fewer patients? The Power of Combination. Answering his own rhetorical question, Hirokovich says one logical way is by becoming larger. This gives the obvious economies of scale and stronger purchasing power, but also provides the healthcare system with a stronger bargaining position with private health insurance companies. Hospitals and insurers negotiate reimbursements for every procedure. If the two sides can't come to an agreement, then the hospital goes on the insurer's out-of-network plan. That's not so bad for the insurer if the hospital is small and not a major player in a given market, but makes that insurer unappealing to health insurance customers. If the out-of-network hospital is a major player, consider if Duke Health or UNC Healthcare were suddenly out of the network of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, many Triangle residents would have to look for another insurance provider. Consolidation gives hospitals a stronger bargaining position for higher reimbursement rates on those negotiated procedures. There is going to be a large amount of consolidation within the hospital industry, Hirokovich says. There are very few for-profit hospitals in North Carolina, though, and it is uncommon for a for-profit organization to buy a non-profit hospital. Duke Health has formed a strategy by which it partnered with the for-profit company LifePoint Hospitals Incorporated, a $3.5 billion for-profit, publicly traded company that operates 60 hospitals in 20 states. They formed the joint venture Duke LifePoint Healthcare and have acquired a majority stake in small rural hospitals in and around North Carolina. WakeMed has its own partnerships as well. The broader arrangement is with Harnett Health, which WakeMed has managed since 2005, and which was a co-applicant in the successful Certificate of Need application to develop Central Harnett Hospital in Lillington, which opened in January. Many of its other partnerships are for specific aspects of a hospital, such as in pediatrics at Central Carolina Hospital, or for cardiac care at Wayne Memorial Hospital and Betsy Johnson Hospital. In most of these cases, the hospitals maintain a larger autonomy. UNC Healthcare has taken a two-pronged approach. In some instances, it acquires a hospital outright and folds it into its own system. It has done this with Rex Healthcare in Raleigh and Chatham Hospital in Siler City, for example. Elsewhere, like Pardee Hospital in Henderson County, it has a long-term operating agreement under which the hospital still has some autonomy, but UNC Healthcare runs the operations. The role of mission. When a hospital is considering a merger or acquisition, Zan confirms that a facility's mission, such as WakeMed's, also plays a role. Before it was taken private in the late 1990s, WakeMed served as Wake County's community hospital with the express mission of treating the county's poorest patients. Even after going private, it has largely maintained that goal. For example, in 2012, the North Carolina Hospital Association estimated its total community benefit at $190 million, a figure which includes $77 million the hospital wrote off as costs of treating charity care patients. Those patients which don't have insurance and cannot afford to pay for medical care. Conversely, Rex Healthcare had a community benefit, $73 million, including $26 million in charity care. When a nonprofit hospital is acquired, it's common to see the acquiring company establish a foundation or promise other kinds of community investments to keep that mission alive. DLP Healthcare established a $30 million foundation with Maria Parham Medical Center in Henderson, for example. In a larger example, Colorado-based Catholic Health Initiatives contributed more than $1 billion to create a new Episcopal Health Foundation when it acquired St. Luke's Episcopal Health System in Houston. Those are both nonprofit hospitals. And along with this cover story, there are three smaller related articles. We'll read those. The first is Hospital M&A's Flood Healthcare Landscape with a Dateline of Durham. One of the growing strategies for Duke University Health System, a nonprofit organization, has been to form a joint venture with LifePoint Hospitals Incorporated, a for-profit, publicly traded company that operates 60 hospitals in 20 states. Formed in 2011, this venture is called DLP Healthcare and has pursued a variety of partnership models with healthcare organizations in and around North Carolina. For example, the JV acquired a majority stake in the MedCath Partners division of MedCath Corporation for $25 million, That deal included the sale of property related to the operation of 9 cardiac catheterization laboratories in North Carolina. Similarly, DLP took an 80% ownership stake of Maria Parham Medical Center in Henderson. It agreed to infuse the system with $45 million for capital improvements over the next decade, as well as establish a new $30 million foundation. Later, it acquired 110-bed Person Memorial Hospital in Roxborough, a hospital that generated $42.4 million in total revenue and $817,000 in profits in 2009. By comparison, Duke Health generated roughly $2.3 billion of revenue that year. DLP also acquired 80% of Twin County Regional Healthcare, a hospital in Galax, Virginia, that generated $50 million in revenue annually. DLP committed $20 million for capital improvements at that hospital. UNC Healthcare, as a public entity, has a slightly different mission than its private nonprofit counterparts in the area, even if those are still different from for-profit hospitals. It, too, has a variety of partnership models, with the largest and most notable in the Triangle being the ownership of Rex Healthcare, the now 660-bed hospital it acquired in 2000. It also owns Chatham Hospital in Siler City, High Point Regional Health System, and Caldwell Memorial Hospital in Lenore. Conversely, it has a 25-year management agreement with Pardee Hospital in Western North Carolina. The Henderson County Board of Commissioners still has some autonomy over the healthcare system there, but UNC Healthcare is responsible for the operations. The healthcare system is also in exclusive talks with Johnston Memorial for a partnership in Johnston County. Although talks are not finalized, UNC Healthcare will partner with Johnston Health by taking a minority stake. Johnston Health will retain majority ownership in the new partnership and also retain control of the board. New affiliates to UNC Healthcare have assessed the same pricing, yielding millions of dollars in annual savings, according to the UNC Healthcare annual report. Adding their purchasing power in turn will further reduce acquisition costs for all of UNC Healthcare. In April, Colorado-based Catholic Health Initiatives announced it would buy St. Luke's Episcopal Health System, a group of Houston-area hospitals, in a deal worth more than $2 billion. This one involved nonprofit entities and was one of the largest deals to involve faith-based hospital systems, which have similar missions. Here, CHI said it will contribute more than $1 billion to create a new Episcopal Health Foundation, which will focus on the unmet health needs of the area's underserved population. It agreed to contribute another $1 billion for future investments at the hospital. When first approaching a merger or acquisition, healthcare systems perform a tricky dance, says Lisa Phillips of Irving Levin Associates, which publishes healthcare merger and acquisition reports. Hospitals don't get to look at each other's books, largely because each side wants to protect the proprietary insurance reimbursements they negotiated with health insurers. Instead, they will give their financials to a third-party firm like PricewaterhouseCoopers for what Phillips called a black box review, in which the third party will assess the financial viability prior to merger negotiations getting underway in full. How these negotiations begin, however, vary widely. Sometimes members of boards have a previously established connection, or maybe chief executives know each other. In some cases, one hospital openly shops itself, or in other cases, one hospital makes an unsolicited or even hostile bid for another hospital. And our last article connected with this cover story is titled, Why Do Hospitals Merge? And it's a Q&A with George Elmsdest, the third, a healthcare mergers and acquisitions lawyer in Florida. How do hospital M&A deals get started? These types of deals get started when one hospital identifies another hospital where it feels it can improve the operation or decrease operation costs or otherwise use the hospital to improve overall income for both hospitals. Sometimes it is merely a matter of a hospital wanting to expand into a larger market or expand into a larger geographical area. In some states, there are communities being serviced by a smaller hospital, but the community has grown to such a level that it needs the support of a larger hospital. How do hospitals feel each other out before agreeing to an M&A? It is our experience that usually this is done at the level of one operational officer or financial officer speaking to his or her counterpart at the other hospital if that hospital is not part of a big chain. Sometimes members of a hospital's board of directors may talk to the board of directors at other hospitals to ensure that their philosophies are similar and will not conflict. How does the patient mix of a hospital play into this? A hospital might be looking to obtain more patients with certain illnesses or conditions to come into its program. Some hospitals also have the ability or desire to specialize in providing different services such as cardiac surgery, wellness programs, labor and delivery, or other such programs. One hospital may be located in an area where there are more patients in a certain category that the other hospital would like to capture and bring into its program. Do you expect to see more of these deals in the future? Yes, larger hospital chains are buying up smaller independent hospitals. I also expect that more independent hospitals will merge or be acquired by other smaller hospitals that provide a similar level of service to keep larger chains out of their markets. And now we turn to the biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. Color commentary from NCSU's AD. Biz caught up with North Carolina State University Athletics Director Debbie Yao during the team's October 12 football game against Syracuse University and had no idea about Yao's prowess when it comes to the X's and O's of football. "Look, the slant formation should open up the tight end," Yao voiced at one point during the game. And what do you know, quarterback Pete Thomas found tight end David Greenidge for 21 yards for the Wolfpack's only touchdown of the game. Yao took the time to also mention that she was happy that the Carolina Hurricanes NCSU scheduling issues at PNC Arena have been resolved and both teams can move on to something that fans want, winning. Generally, Biz is not a big college football fan, but watching a little part of the game with Yao was quite a treat, like having a member of the coaching staff beside you, taking you through the motions of the game. Tweeting with the Stars from Raleigh. When Raleigh entrepreneur Brooks Bell read the Washington Post this week, she wasn't exactly surprised to see her name as a Twitter board prospect. Entrepreneurial pundit Vivek Wadhwa named her among 16 potentials, not just for Twitter's board, but for technology boards overall. His column, citing an ongoing social media debate with Twitter over its lack of women in leadership roles, lists Bell alongside the likes of PepsiCo CEO Indra Nooyi and USA Network founder Kay Koplowitz. "I'm just totally inspired, you know, that he thinks highly of me in that way and that he considers me a leader," Bell says. GE Energy brings global team to Cary. When Dan Janke, the president and CEO of GE Energy Management, gave the green light for GE to expand its small research team in Cary, they pulled in experts from around the world. Australia native Stuart Thompson, the new general manager of power equipment, was relocated from an assignment in Shanghai. Norm Sowards, the general manager of power components, was moved to the Triangle about a year ago from Ohio. In addition to providing support for GE's big electrical components plant in Mebane, the new Cary office will serve as the global headquarters for both power equipment and power components. Whitehurst, how to build a team gym. Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst doesn't need a mentor. He has a team gym. "Build a team of people who know you and whom you also know well," he says in his blog. "Build a team of people who know you from the different aspects and times of your life." Instead of a professional mentor, he suggests an advisory team of people who care about you and your success and growth. Team gym members include his wife, college and business school friends, former partners from Boston Consulting Group, and other people he's met in his career. No word on whether the team has Team Gym t-shirts. Of course, for Whitehurst, it might be more appropriate to have Team Gym hats. Fall feasting brings crowd to Durham Inn. "Wish You Were Here" was the theme on October 15 as the Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club hosted a preview of its fall seasonal menu. Washington Duke's executive chef, Jason Cunningham, was in the kitchen preparing six mouth-watering dishes, such as the pecan-encrusted Carolina grouper, sweet tea poulet rouge, and a cinnamon sugar cronut served with homemade root beer ice cream. The food came out in waves in what the Washington Duke referred to as a movable feast, and guests were able to sample beverages from Hillsboro's Mystery Brewing and Shelton Vineyards of Dobson. After the guests finished the samples, our state magazine's editor-in-chief, Elizabeth Hudson, read a verse from her latest release, Wish You Were Here, a collection of essays. At the end of the evening, each guest received a complimentary copy of Hudson's book, signed by the author and by the book's illustrator, Suzanne Cabrera. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Jason DeBrun, Lauren Onsorge, and Dathan Kazuk. And now we return to a full-length article in the Triangle Business Journal. And this article is headlined, Tech Companies Hook Employees with Culture. And the article is written by Lauren Onsorge with the Dateline of Cary. Mike Lipps, General Manager of Cary-based Business of Law Software Solutions Division at New York's LexisNexis, is fighting for your resume with 27 open jobs. Lipps wants to wrestle applicants from the big guns in technology, IBM, Red Hat, etc., and he's armed. His weapon of choice is culture, a sword that he says speaks for itself. Not that he will shy away from evangelizing it personally or dropping money on improvements he feels will push LexisNexis to the top of your job wish list. Well before the firm signed its lease at Centennial Campus, which begins in 2014, they knew a move was on the horizon. It was a closely guarded secret pursued as his company was dropping $1 million to renovate its Cary campus just last year. Even as new desks were installed in the open space on the fifth floor, Lipps knew that setup was temporary, but he's not at all sorry about spending the cash. It's an investment in our people, he says, adding that 90% of the upgrades can be moved to the new building. It's kind of like a life science research lab. People really like the honeycomb formation, Lipps says, pointing to the open clusters of desks. The rest of the LexisNexis team is paying attention. The company's Park Avenue headquarters in New York City is moving across the street, shifting from Wall Street mahogany to Cary-inspired bright colors. It's spreading, Lipps says. Tapped from a Silicon Valley Intuit post in 2009, Lipps says the open space isn't just about collaboration or oversight. But when I sit here with a laptop, I hear all kinds of feedback, he says, pointing to a taller bar-style table in between sets of low-rise cubicles. Names such as IBM, Red Hat, Citrix, and Lenovo are known for attracting talent, and with expansions in play by companies such as Citrix and Imprio in Raleigh, there's no dearth of job openings, meaning top candidates can be pickier than ever before. LexisNexis has to fight to get that talent, and culture is a weapon in that battle. It sets us apart, he says. But he's not the only one recognizing the hiring potential of culture. California-based Citrix, which, through the acquisition of Raleigh-based ShareFile, is not only officially in the Triangle, but also investing here. The company just had the topping ceremony on its new structure in the Warehouse District of downtown Raleigh. ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson says its culture is a recruitment tool. Already established players such as Red Hat are throwing the word culture into their recruitment conversations, and they know exactly what companies such as LexisNexis and Citrix are up to. People want our talent, Red Hat Chief People Officer Delisa Alexander has said. Other companies and other associations are seeking what Red Hat associates have. But Lipps, who isn't targeting a particular company's employees, hopes that what LexisNexis has is being noticed, too. And this competition isn't new for the Mountain View, California native. You had Google on one side of you, and then you had Apple, he says, adding that RTP and Silicon Valley are similar in recruitment. You have to work really hard. You have to pay them, obviously, but you have to work really hard to create that environment. And while sometimes potential hires can be lost to tech peers, it's that competitive environment that has made the Triangle so attractive in the first place, Lipps reminds. When you're here, you have access and opportunity to get world-class technology talent, he says, adding that it's still a competitive process to be the next LexisNexis engineer. And now we turn to the A Better World page. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we read Todd Cohen's column that's headlined, Youth Literacy Emerges as Critical Issue in Determining Future Success. 1 in 3 North Carolina third graders and 4 in 10 from low-income households do not read at grade level, typically because their brains get too little stimulation in their earliest months and years, experts say. Many children are not ready for school, struggle in the classroom, and drop out, with only 80% of students in the state graduating from high school after 4 years. Those same kids are more likely to end up jobless, homeless, in jails or emergency rooms, and on public assistance. The Institute for a Competitive Workforce at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce estimates 80 million to 90 million adults, or roughly half the workforce, lack the basic education and communication skills needed to get jobs and advance in them, says Susan Perry Manning, executive director of the North Carolina Early Childhood Foundation. Awareness of the importance of youth literacy and efforts to improve it are growing. Poor academic performance often is rooted in lack of support for learning that kids get at home, particularly in the first 12 months of their lives, when their brains reach their peak potential for developing cognitive skills, as well as the social and emotional skills critical to succeed in school and life, experts say. The parent is the child's first teacher, says Tracy Greggs, Early Literacy Project Coordinator for the WAKE Education Partnership. Research shows the first and best indicator of whether or not a child will be successful in school is the amount of time the parent has with that child. By age 3, for example, the vocabularies of children of college-educated parents are 2 to 3 times larger than those of children whose parents have not completed high school, a gap that puts kids with smaller vocabularies at a huge disadvantage, Perry Manning says. Starting this year, because of a new state law in North Carolina, third graders who cannot read at grade level at the end of the school year will not advance to fourth grade. Students who fail the end-of-year reading tests can attend the summer sessions to improve their reading and then take the test again. This year, the WAKE Education Partnership launched an early childhood initiative to help make sure kids are ready for kindergarten and reading at grade level by the end of third grade. And the North Carolina Early Childhood Foundation, formed this summer initially, will work to raise awareness about early childhood development, Perry Manning says. The foundation will make sense of data on effective strategies for improving child development, and it aims to bring together leaders, experts, educators, parents, and others to foster collaborative statewide and local solutions to help kids succeed by the end of third grade, Perry Manning says. There is no silver bullet, she says. The reason children aren't successful at the end of third grade is complicated. We know it's about more than just any one program. And in nonprofit news, Interfaith Food Shuttle will help people learn how to make healthier food choices. Called Cooking Matters at the Store, the program helps families at risk for hunger make healthy and affordable choices at the supermarket. Classes will take place across the 7-county service area in the Triangle at 11 Food Lion stores. More than 400 individuals are expected to participate. This educational event is made possible by a $10,000 donation from Food Lion. The classes will take place on October 24. The Boys and Girls Club of Wake County were the beneficiaries of the latest Greenscape Incorporated service project. Based in Holly Springs, Greenscape picks various service projects throughout the year to benefit the Triangle's communities. Work for the most recent project included enhancing the club's outdoor spaces, improving the sports fields, pruning, mulching, planting, and general cleanup. Greenscape partner John Deere Landscapes donated plants, seeds, and fertilizer, and Atlantic Mulch and Erosion Control donated mulch for the project. People on the move. Deborah Saunders White, Chancellor of North Carolina Central University, was elected to the Board of Directors of the United Way of the Greater Triangle. Mishimasa Fujino, the founding president and CEO of Honda Aircraft Company, was inducted into the Junior Achievement of Central North Carolina's Business Leaders Hall of Fame. Band Together North Carolina named George Redden and Jim Triendafleu to its advisory board, Sarah Crawford, Brendan Morrissey, Stephen Porterfield, Bob Ramser, Bert Smith, Brent Sprinkle, and Karen Zeldin were named to Band Together North Carolina's board of directors. Katie Crumpler joined the North Carolina Community Foundation as a regional associate for the Northern Piedmont, serving Franklin, Granville, Johnson, Person, Vance, and Wake counties. And now we turn to the reporter pages. First, we have the page of Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And there are three sections to her page. The first is a short graph titled Know Thy Market. Triangle home sales prices show uptick in September. $229,013. That's the average home price in September, a 4.4% increase from the year prior. And monthly home sales in September of this year are down slightly from August. The monthly home sales for September 2013, 2,895. And in August 2013, it was 2,325. And then there's a short article headlined, Sales Are Finally Up, But May Slow by Year's End. Looking ahead, Triangle residential sales agents say they are seeing a slowdown in the number of pending home sales relative to earlier in the year. Some home builders are starting to offer incentives to buyers again to close the deal, which could signal a weaker end to 2013. But sales in September were still up 16% year over year and up 23% for the third quarter, according to the Triangle Multiple Listing Service. At the Heritage Wake Forest community, 65 homes were sold in the third quarter, nearly matching the 2005 third quarter high of 67 sales, says Andy Ammons, president of Ammons Development Group and developer of the Heritage. New home sale prices at the Heritage also continue to rise, with a 5% increase for the quarter. The third quarter results indicate that the market continues to improve, Ammons says. We typically see a sales slip during third quarter, but this year we didn't, and we're looking forward to a strong fourth quarter finish to 2013. And finally, in a They Said It section, there's a picture of Warren Buffett with a quote from him. I bought my house in 1958, so this fall I will have been in it 55 years. It's the best investment, with the exception of those two wedding rings I made. It's not that I have made much money on it, but the memories, the happiness, you can't buy that. Warren Buffett, chairman and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, in a video introducing the new name for Home Services of America, owner of three big residential real estate firms in North Carolina, including Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, York Simpson Underwood Realty, in the Triangle. And now we move on to the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurship. And there are a few sections on this page. We'll start with On the Web and the headline, State's CIO Juggles Needs of Multiple Agencies. In light of the new Innovation Center opening last week, I chatted with North Carolina's Chief Information Officer, Chris Estes. Estes says he's been able to avoid political drama and stay focused on his job. And here are a few of his quotes. We work in silos. Many of the agencies are buying things that sometimes aren't working, or they're not buying them in a way that would allow us to share them at an enterprise level. I think the biggest challenge is just shifting the culture from a siloed business model to an enterprise collaborative business model and helping people who are now embracing this culture of working together and sharing. The state historically has issued requests for approvals. The vendors respond, and we spend 10 years making it work. And then there's this section is also a picture of Governor Pat McCrory speaking at the grand opening of the Innovation Center in Raleigh. The Innovation Center, what Governor Pat McCrory says is a big step toward making state government user-friendly, opened its doors in downtown Raleigh last week. McCrory calls the center the fulfillment of his April statements that the state would create a proving ground for IT programs. It's where the state will test new technology prior to purchasing it. a move that directly responds to an audit showing the actual costs of 84 previous projects were $356 million more than originally anticipated. And also on this page, we have a few short articles. The first one has the headline, Robotic Tools Manufacturer Adds 200 Jobs in Apex. ATI Industrial Automation is taking a big gamble on its exports business, and with a groundbreaking ceremony on its latest expansion this Friday, there's no turning back, says CEO Robert Little. ATI says its latest move, driven by a new focus on exports, a segment that already makes up 40% of its business, will create 200 new jobs in varied sectors, including engineering, operations, and manufacturing. Little says things are finally starting to look up for the company, which was smacked by the 2009 recession. We were right in the middle of it, he recalls, adding that automation, the focus of his business, is starting to pick up. First, he says, was the automotive sector. Next came areas such as aerospace and packaging. Many plants throughout the U.S. are looking to automate, and that's our product, he explains. This has meant dramatic growth for us, and we have to prepare for the future. The company had just finished an expansion of its headquarters when it decided to get even bigger. We're already seeing signs of that building getting full, he says. And they're still hiring, gearing up to push its exports from 40% of its business to 50%, focusing on markets in China, Thailand, and Brazil. Little says the company looked in places such as Fuquay Varina, Holly Springs, and Cary, and settled on Apex because of the small town feel and commute. Moving outside of the Triangle wasn't an option, he says, because of the North Carolina State University talent pool it has come to rely on over the years. The robotic tools manufacturer will now take up nearly 129,000 square feet. That will occur in two phases, with the first phase of construction to start immediately and the second phase in 3 to 5 years. And then also an article from the web titled, Apex Military Defense Firm Can Protect Your Business. In the heart of Apex, a newly combined company is preparing for battle. Dale Scales, CEO of American Defense Systems, is quick to point out that his company's type of security isn't what you typically think of when you think about Research Triangle Park. It's the physical security industry, he says. Think security measures that transform construction vehicles into machines that can withstand the rigors of war. We work with a lot of the armed forces and the Department of Defense, he explains. We have done outfitting or upfitting for some of the armored vehicles. The company's specialty has been in military construction vehicles, but it's also growing its business in the private sector. We work basically with companies that would really like to protect their facilities from any type of threat, he says. And thanks to the recent acquisition of American Physical Security Group, he's about to take his company to the front lines, literally. APSG's specialty is security gates. Add that to what ADS already offers, and it's a combined 23-person operation, Scale says. And the final article on this page is titled, How Bluetooth Was Born in Research Triangle Park. Britain native Paul Dent now lives in the wilds of Chatham County. I like to have a lot of land for doing strange things, he says. Today's strange things include toying with solar panels and wind generators, but decades ago it was an idea that led to a technology vital to that phone in your pocket, Bluetooth. And that science stemmed from a conversation he had in Research Triangle Park when he was chief scientist at Ericsson, the job that brought him to RTP in 1991. A lot of people say I invented Bluetooth, he laughs. I was probably the first guy to talk to my boss about doing it and come up with a scheme to do it, but so many people came together to do it. It was in the days when the cell phone was still a fairly expensive tool, mostly used by the traveling businessman, and my boss said, this is what I want to do. When I take a trip with my phone in my shirt pocket and my laptop in my briefcase, I want to already be receiving emails through my cell phone and to my laptop. The goal, Dent recalls, was for it to happen instantaneously as his boss walked down the gangplank so that when he sat in the terminal, all of his emails would be waiting for him. I knew the only way to do that was a short-range radio wavelength, he says, noting that other methods couldn't get through the leather of that briefcase to the laptop. I thought, well, if we can replace that, what would normally be a cable and two connectors and two plugs with something this cheap, it could then be used for everything, he says. And today, that's what it's used for, Bluetooth technology can link your smartphone to everything from a laptop to a toaster, a far cry from what they first envisioned. It's amazing how little dumb ideas like that arise between two guys having a lunchtime discussion can turn into a multi-billion dollar business, he says. And he's hoping another conversation, this time with Wrightsville Beach entrepreneur Stephen Burnett, can create another technological tidal wave. When Ericsson announced in 2009 that it would be closing its Research Triangle Park campus and moving to California, Dent was among the inventors who stayed behind to start my own thing. That thing has become startup Coolbridge Solar Incorporated, a just incorporated business he's founded with Burnett, aimed at creating cheaper solar cells. And our next reporter page is that of Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. The headline on his first article, Healthcare Spending Skewed Toward Sickest Patients. That the sickest people account for a higher percentage of healthcare spending isn't new, but numbers released recently by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, a unit of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, show just how disparate our spending on healthcare has become. In 2010, the top 1% of sickest people accounted for 21.4% of total healthcare expenditures, with an annual mean expenditure of $87,570. The top 5% of the population accounted for 49.9% of total expenditures, with an annual mean expenditure of $40,876. Total healthcare spending that year hit $1.263 trillion, meaning 5% of the sickest patients account for nearly $632 billion of healthcare spending. In addition, the top 10% of the population accounted for 65.6% of total expenditures, with an annual mean expenditure of $26,851. Overall, the top 50% of the population ranked by their expenditures accounted for 97.2% of overall healthcare expenditures, while the lower 50% accounted for only 2.8% of the total. Those individuals ranked in the top half of the healthcare expenditure distribution had an annual mean expenditure of $7,960. And in this section titled The Take, the headline is Rex Healthcare Opens New Oncology Center in Garner. Rex Healthcare, a wholly owned subsidiary of UNC Healthcare, opened Rex Hematology Oncology Associates of Garner. Rex hopes to attract patients from southern Wake County as well as Johnston County and other areas. The North Carolina Office of Budget and Management projects Wake County's population to increase by 106,000 in the next 5 years, or an 11% growth from July 2013. Much of that growth is projected to happen toward the southern suburbs of Raleigh. The new practice is led by medical oncologist, hematologist, Dr. Brendan D. McNulty. McNulty most recently practiced at a satellite cancer center outside of Boston for the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Doctors will team with the Rex Cancer Center in Raleigh, the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, and the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill. Rex already has radiation cancer treatment at Clayton Radiation Oncology and Smithfield Radiation Oncology, a joint partnership of Johnston Health and Rex UNC Healthcare. Rex Healthcare outperformed its operating budget, but underperformed when non-operating metrics are considered, according to preliminary unaudited financial reports. For the fiscal year ended June 30, 2013, Rex generated $643 million of net patient revenue, or about 1.3% more than budgeted. The hospital came in at lower than budgeted expenses for net operating income of $51 million, or 33% higher than budgeted. At $3 million, however, non-operating income came in at only 21% of the budget, leaving Rex with a net income of $18 million for the year, or 42% of budget. Rex is a not-for-profit hospital with 660 total beds that treats 34,000 patients each year. It employs 5,400 workers. And our next section is By the Numbers. The headline on it, shutdown drives gas prices to lowest of the year. Gas prices have fallen 20 cents this month and are expected to keep dropping. Why? Summer is over, gasoline is switching to winter fuels, furloughed government workers are not commuting, and the shutdown has markets uncertain. The average gas price is $3.21. The average last month was $3.41. And the summer high was $3.56. And the next section is titled Power Bill, Triangle Area Road Funding. The North Carolina Department of Transportation awards road improvement funds to municipalities each year based on number of city-maintained roads and population. The money is allocated for repairs, maintenance, and construction, like widening and adding sidewalks to streets. Charlotte gets $19.8 million. Raleigh-Durham, $16.3 million. Cary, $3.6 million. And Chapel Hill, $1.4 million. And in our final short article, headlined, Taking the Bridge to Hatteras Will Be Safer and Quicker After Construction. On November 1, bids will open on the $215 million contract to build a new bridge to replace the old Bonner Bridge on NC-12 in the Outer Banks. Construction is set to start in the spring of 2014 and will take at least 3 years to complete and accept traffic. As many as 13,000 vehicles cross the bridge during peak travel days in the summer. Bonner Bridge allows for passage over Oregon Inlet and runs to Rodanthe. The last business before the bridge is the Oregon Inlet Fishing Center Marina, a charter boat station from which you can see Bonner Bridge. Local year-round employees are looking forward to the bridge's construction, not only because it's a long-awaited improvement, but because construction workers bring business to the marina. The bridge, located in Dare County, opened in the early 1960s and is the only highway connecting Hatteras Island to mainland North Carolina. And now we'll read from the Viewpoint page, and we'll read the guest opinion. And this guest opinion is from Alexander Forder Sirota. She is the director of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center in Raleigh. The headline on her guest opinion, her viewpoint, Prosperity Zone Not Equally Prosperous. As the North Carolina Department of Commerce launches its listening tour to develop 10-year economic development goals, it is critical to remember that different parts of the state are facing dramatically different economic conditions. As a result, many of these regions are failing to experience the benefits of a growing economy. This is perhaps most obvious when comparing the economic performance of the state's 8 prosperity zones, new administrative regions established by the Department of Commerce to help coordinate economic development activities across a number of state agencies and geographic regions. It is clear that not all of the new prosperity zones in the state are doing well economically. In fact, half of the 8 zones have actually lost employment from August 2007 to August 2013. For example, while the Southwest Zone, which includes the fast-growing Charlotte-Mecklenburg metro area, experienced almost 5% employment growth, the rural Northeastern Zone saw the number of employed persons decline over the period more than 5%. A closer look at intrastate migration patterns is needed, but this cursory look suggests that rural regions are losing employment at high rates and urban areas continue to grow, which raises important questions for the types of strategies that can drive improved employment in more geographically dispersed communities. Understanding these trends is critical to developing policies that not only create jobs and grow the economy, but do so in a way that produces broadly shared prosperity across all regions in the state. Any 10-year economic development plan must recognize this fundamental reality. Prosperity that is concentrated in a handful of counties but does not penetrate communities across the state is not real prosperity at all. As a result, the new economic development plan must incorporate strategies directed at promoting prosperity in all regions of the state. And also from the Viewpoint page, we'll read as much as we can of the guest column, which is written by Jim Blom, who is the CEO of Bayer Crop Science in Research Triangle Park. The headline, for all of us, challenges remain in addressing global food needs. I've always marveled at the enterprising spirit and dedicated commitment of the average American. During times of crisis or adversity, it seems there is an inherent linkage among ordinary people from all walks of life to come together to do the most extraordinary things. Perhaps this is because we are a melting pot of many cultures united by the common bond of citizenship, which drives us to greater collaboration for the common good. On October 16, we commemorated World Food Day, which represents an opportunity for all Americans to come together once again to play a larger role in ending the persistent hunger that exists around the globe. For more than 30 years since its inception by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, World Food Day has helped mobilize organizations across international boundaries to foster greater collaboration toward ending malnutrition and poverty, and to draw attention to the significant achievements in food production and agricultural innovation. The focus for this year is sustainable food systems for food security and nutrition, a theme tailor-made for American agriculture. The number of people fed by the average U.S. farmer has increased from 27 in 1950 to more than 150 today. This amazing growth in productivity is due to many factors: advances in equipment, better soil management and nutrition, innovative crop protection products, and genetically modified plants, all of which have helped farmers bring more of their crops' innate potential to harvest and to market. This success is a result of the collaborative work of research scientists, agronomists, economists, logisticians, financiers, and many others who have helped to ensure our agricultural sustainability. And actually, we're going to stop right there because we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.